Chapter 2. I begin to remember myself very late, not till I was nearly 9 years old. I don't know how it was, but everything, what happened to me before that age, has left no impression I can recall now. But from the time I was 8 and a half, I remember everything very distinctly, day by day, without a break, as though everything that happened then had occurred not longer ago than yesterday. It is true I can, as though in a dream, remember something earlier, a little lamp always burning in a dark corner before an old-fashioned icon, then my being once kicked in the street by a horse, from which, as I was told afterwards, I lay ill in bed for 3 months. Then, too, during that illness, my waking up at night beside my mother with whom I was sleeping, and being suddenly terrified by my sick dreams, the stillness of the night, and the mice scratching in the corner, and trembling with terror all night, huddling under the bedclothes, but not daring to wake my mother, from which I conclude that my fear of her was greater than any other terror. But from the minute when I began to be conscious of myself, I developed rapidly, surprisingly, and was terribly capable of receiving many quite unchildlike impressions. Everything became clear before my eyes, everything became intelligible to me extremely quickly. The time from which I begin to remember my feelings well made a vivid and sorrowful impression on me. This impression was repeated every day afterwards and grew stronger every day. It threw a strange and gloomy colour over the whole time I lived with my parents and over the whole of my childhood too. It seems to me now that I became suddenly conscious, as though awaking from deep sleep, though at the time, of course, the change cannot have been so startling. I found myself in a big room with a low-pitched ceiling, stuffy and unclean. The walls were coloured a dirty grey tint. In the corner stood a huge Russian stove. The windows looked out into the street, or more accurately, onto the roof of the house opposite, and were low and broad, like chinks. The window-sills were so high from the floor that I remember I had to push the table up, set a stool on it, and so clamber up to the window in which I was very fond of sitting when there was no one at home. From our room one could see half the town. We lived just under the roof of a very huge six-story house. Our furniture consisted of a relic of a sofa with the stuffing coming out, covered with American leather and coated with dust. A plain white table, two chairs, my mother's bed, in the corner a little cupboard with things in it, a chest of drawers which always stood tilted to one side, and a torn paper screen. I remember that it was dusk. Everything was in disorder and had been flung about, brushes, rags, our wooden bowls and spoons, a broken bottle, and I don't know what else besides. I remember that my mother was intensely excited and was crying about something. My stepfather was sitting in a corner in the tattered frock coat he always wore. He said something sarcastic, which made her angrier than ever, and then brushes and bowls began flying about again. I burst out crying. I began screaming and rushed at them both. I was in a terrible panic and put my arms round my stepfather to shield him. God knows why, but it seemed to me that my mother had no reason to be angry with him, that he was not to blame. I wanted to beg forgiveness for him, to bear any punishment for his sake. I was dreadfully frightened of my mother, and imagined that everyone else was equally afraid of her. At first my mother was astonished. Then she took me by the hand and dragged me away behind the screen. I knocked my arm against the bedstead, rather painfully, but my terror was greater than the pain, and I did not even wince. I remember, too, that my mother began hotly and bitterly saying something to my father and pointing at me. I will henceforward call him my father, as it was only much later that I learned that he was not related to me. The whole scene lasted about 2 hours, and, quivering with suspense, I did my very utmost to guess how it would end. At last the quarrel subsided, and my mother went out. Then my father called me, kissed me, stroked my head, took me on his knee, and I nestled closely, sweetly, to his bosom. It was, perhaps, the first caress I had ever received from either parent, and perhaps that is why I began to remember everything so distinctly from that time. I observed, too, that I had gained my father's favour by defending him, and the idea occurred to me, I believe for the first time, that he had a great deal to put up with and suffered at my mother's hands. From that time this idea was always with me, and made me more indignant every day. From that moment I began to feel a boundless love for my father, but a strange sort of love, not a childlike feeling. I should say that it was rather a compassionate, motherly feeling, if such a definition of my love were not rather absurd as applied to a child. My father always seemed to me so much to be pitied, so persecuted, so crushed, such a victim, that it seemed to me a terrible and unnatural thing not to love him passionately, not to comfort him and be kind to him, not to do one's utmost for him. But I don't understand to this day how the idea entered my head that my father was such a victim, the most unhappy man in the world. Who had instilled that idea into me? In what way could a child, such as I was, have any understanding of his failures? But I did understand them, though I interpreted them and changed them in my imagination. But to this day I cannot conceive how this impression was formed. Perhaps my mother was too severe with me, and I attached myself to my father as a creature suffering together with me from the same cause. I have already described my first awakening from the sleep of childhood, the first stirrings of life in me. My heart was wounded from the first moment, and my development began with inconceivable and exhausting rapidity. I could no longer be satisfied with external impressions alone. I began to think, to reason, to notice, but this noticing began so unnaturally early that my imagination could not but interpret in its own way what was noticed, and I found myself all at once in a world apart. Everything around me began to be like the fairy tale which my father used often to tell me, and which I could not but take for the holy truth. A strange idea arose in me. I became fully aware, though I don't know how it came about, that I was living in a strange home, and that my parents were utterly unlike the other people I had chanced to meet at that time. Why is it, I wondered, why is it I see other people unlike my parents, even in appearance? How is it that I have noticed laughter on other faces, and how is it that I was at once struck by the fact that in our corner they never laughed, they never rejoiced? What force, what cause drove me, a child of nine, to look about me so diligently, and listen to every word uttered by the people I chanced to meet on the stairs, or in the street when, covering my rags with my mother's old jacket, I went out in the evening with a few coppers to buy a few ha'porths of sugar, tea, or bread? I understood, and I don't remember how I came to, that there was everlasting, unbearable sorrow in our garret. I racked my brains trying to guess why it was so, and I don't know who helped me to solve the riddle in my own way. I blamed my mother, and accepted her as my father's evil genius. And I repeat, I don't know how so monstrous an idea could have taken shape in my brain. And the more attached I became to my father, the more I grew to hate my mother. The memory of all this is a deep and bitter anguish to me to this day. Here is another incident, which did even more than the first to strengthen my strange devotion to my father. About 9 o'clock one evening, my mother sent me out to the shop for some yeast. My father was not at home. On my way back, I fell down in the street and spilt the whole cup. My first thought was how angry my mother would be. At the same time, I felt a horrible pain in my left arm and could not get up. Passers-by stopped round me. An old woman began picking me up, and a boy running by hit me on the head with a key. At last I was set upon my feet. I picked up the pieces of the broken cup and walked on, staggering, hardly able to put one leg before the other. Suddenly I caught sight of my father. He was standing in a crowd before a grand house that was opposite our lodging. This house belonged to people of consequence and was brilliantly lighted up. A great number of carriages had driven up to the entrance, and strains of music floated down from the windows into the street. I clutched my father by the skirt of his frock coat, pointed to the pieces of the broken cup, and with tears began saying that I was afraid to go in to mother. I felt somehow sure that he would stand up for me, but why was I convinced of it? Who had suggested to me, who had instilled into me that he loved me more than my mother did? Why was it I approached him without fear? He took me by the hand, began comforting me, then said he wanted to show me something, and lifted me up in his arms. I could not see anything, for he took me by my bruised arm, and it hurt me frightfully, but I did not cry out for fear of wounding him. He kept asking me whether I saw something. I did my utmost to answer so as to please him, and said that I could see red curtains. When he wanted to carry me to the other side of the street, nearer to the house, I suddenly, I don't know why, began crying, hugging him and entreating him to make haste and take me up to mother. I remember that my father's caresses were bitter to me at the time, and I could not bear the thought that one of the two people I so longed to love loved me and was kind to me, while I dared not go to the other and was afraid. But my mother was scarcely angry at all, and sent me to bed at once. I remember that the pain in my arm, growing more and more acute, made me feverish. Yet I was particularly happy that it had all gone off so well, and dreamed all night of the house with the red curtains. And when I woke next morning, my first thought, my first care, was the house with the red curtains. As soon as my mother had gone out, I clambered up to the little window and began looking at it. The house had long ago excited my childish curiosity. I liked looking at it particularly in the evening, when the street was lighted up, and when the crimson-red curtains behind the plate-glass windows of the brightly lighted house began to gleam with a peculiar blood-red glow. Sumptuous carriages with lovely, proud horses were continually driving up to the front door, and everything attracted my curiosity, the clamour and bustle at the entrance, and the different coloured lamps of the carriages, and the grandly dressed women who arrived in them. All this took, in my childish imagination, an air of royal magnificence and fairy-tale enchantment. Now, since my meeting with my father before the grand house, it became doubly marvellous and interesting. Now, strange conceptions and theories began to stir in my excited imagination, and I am not surprised that, between two such strange people as my father and mother, I became such a strange, fantastic child. I was peculiarly affected by the contrast of their characters. I was struck, for instance, by the fact that my mother was continually working and worrying to gain our poor livelihood, was continually reproaching my father that she was the only one to toil for us all, and I could not help asking myself the question, why was it my father did not help her at all? Why was it that he lived like a stranger in our home? One or two words dropped by my mother gave me a notion about this, and with some astonishment, I learned that my father was an artist. That word I retained in my memory, that my father was a man of genius. The notion that an artist was a special sort of man, unlike others, shaped itself immediately in my imagination. Possibly my father's behaviour led me to that reflection. Perhaps I had heard something which now has escaped my memory, but the meaning of my father's words uttered before me on one occasion with peculiar feeling was strangely intelligible to me. The words were, "The time would come when he would not be in poverty, when he would be a gentleman and wealthy, and, in fact, he would rise again when my mother died." I remember that at first I was fearfully frightened at those words. I could not stay in the room. I ran out into our cold passage and there burst into sobs, with my elbows on the windowsill and my face in my hands. But afterwards, when I had pondered continually over it, when I had grown used to my father's horrible desire, my wild imagination came to my assistance. Yes, I could not long remain in the agony of uncertainty, and absolutely had to fix upon some supposition. And so, I don't know how it all began at first, but in the end I fastened upon the idea that when my mother died, my father would leave this dreary garret, and would go away somewhere with me. But where? Up to the last I could not clearly picture. I remember only that everything with which I could beautify the place to which we were going, and I made up my mind for certain that we were going together, everything brilliant, luxurious, and magnificent I could create in my wild imagination, all this was brought into play in these daydreams. I fancied that we should at once become rich. I should not have to go on errands to the shops, which was very hard for me because the children living in the next house tormented me whenever I went out, and I was dreadfully afraid, particularly when I was carrying milk or oil, and knew that if I spilt it, I should be severely punished. Then in my dreams I decided that my father would at once get new clothes, that we should go to live in a splendid house. And here, the grand house with the red curtains, and my meeting near it with my father, who wanted to show me something in it, came to the assistance of my imagination, and it followed immediately in my conjectures that we should move into that house, and should live in it in perpetual bliss, keeping a sort of perpetual holiday. From that time forth, I used to look out of the window in the evenings with intense curiosity at that house, which seemed to me enchanted, recalling the crowd of visitors more grandly dressed than I had ever seen before. I imagined those strains of sweet music floating out of the windows, and watched the shadows flitting on the window curtains, and kept trying to guess what was going on there, and it always seemed to me that over there it was paradise and a perpetual holiday. I grew to hate our poor abode, the rags in which I went about. And one day, when my mother scolded me and told me to get down from the window, to which I had climbed up as usual, the idea came into my head at once that she did not want me to look at that house, that she did not want me to think of it, that she disliked the thought of our happiness, that she wanted to prevent it. I looked at my mother intently and suspiciously all that evening. And how could such unfeeling callousness in regard to a creature so continually suffering as my mother have arisen in me? It is only now that I understand what a misery her life was, and I cannot think of her martyrdom without pain. Even then, in the dark period of my strange childhood, in the period of this unnatural development, my heart often ached from pain and pity, and uneasiness, bewilderment, and doubt lay heavily on my soul. Even then, conscience was rising up within me, and often, with distress and misery, I felt my injustice towards my mother. But we had somehow become estranged from one another, and I cannot remember ever being affectionate to her. Now, even the most trifling recollection lacerates and tears at my heart. I remember once, of course, what I am describing now is trivial, paltry, coarse, but it is just such reminiscences which torture me especially, and are imprinted upon my memory more poignantly than anything. One evening, when my father was not at home, my mother sent me to the shop to buy her tea and sugar. But she kept hesitating, unable to decide, and counting over her coppers the pitiful sum she could spend. She was calculating, I think, for half an hour, and seemed still unable to reckon it to her satisfaction. Moreover, there were moments when probably she sank into a sort of stupor. As I remember now, she kept talking on, reckoning in low, measured tones, as though dropping her words accidentally. Her lips and her cheeks were pale, her hands always trembled, and she always kept shaking her head when she was thinking in solitude. "No, no need," she said, looking at me. "I had better go to bed. Eh? Are you asleep, Nietochka?" I did not answer. Then she lifted up my head and looked at me so gently, so caressingly, Her face lighted up and glowed with such a motherly smile that my heart ached and began beating faster. Besides, she had called me Nietochka, which meant that she was feeling particularly fond of me. She had invented that name herself, lovingly transforming my name Anna into the diminutive Nietochka, and when she called me that, it meant that she felt affectionate. I was touched. I longed to hug her, to nestle up to her and weep with her. And for a long time she stroked my head, poor woman, perhaps mechanically in the end, forgetting that she was fondling me, while she kept repeating, "My child, Aneta, Nietochka." The tears were gushing from my eyes, but I made an effort and controlled myself. I was somehow stubborn in not displaying my feelings before her, though I was inwardly distressed. But that could not have been natural hard-heartedness in me. She could not have so turned me against her simply by her severity to me. No! I was corrupted by my fantastic, exclusive love for my father. I sometimes woke at night in my short little bed under the chilly quilt, and I was always frightened. Half asleep, I remembered how, not long ago, when I was smaller, I slept with my mother and was not so frightened when I woke up at night. I had only to nestle up to her, shut my eyes, and hug her tight, and I would go to sleep again at once. I still felt as though I could not help loving her in secret. I have noticed since that many children are abnormally unfeeling, and if they love anyone, they love that one exclusively. That is how it was with me. Sometimes there would be a death-like silence in our garret for a whole week. My father and mother were weary of quarrelling, and I lived between them as before, always silent, always brooding, always fretting, and always struggling to arrive at something in my dreams. Watching them, I fully grasped their attitude to one another. I understood the obscure, never-ending antagonism between them, understood all the sorrow and all the stupefying influences of the disordered existence which had made our garret its home. Of course, I understood it without grasping cause or effect. I understood it, of course, only as far as I was capable of understanding. Sometimes, on the long winter evenings, huddled in some corner, I would watch them eagerly for hours together and gaze into my father's face, trying all the while to guess what he was thinking about, what was interesting him. Then I was impressed and frightened by my mother. She kept walking up and down the room without stopping for hours at a time, often even at night, in the attacks of sleeplessness from which she suffered. She would walk up and down, whispering to herself as though she were alone in the room, flinging wide her arms or folding them across her bosom or wringing her hands in terrible, never-ending misery. Sometimes tears streamed down her cheeks, tears which perhaps she herself did not understand. She was suffering from a very complicated disease, which she neglected entirely. I remember that I became more and more oppressed by my solitude and the silence I did not dare to break. I had been for a whole year living a conscious life, always thinking, dreaming, and tormented in secret by unintelligible, obscure impulses which had suddenly sprung up in me. I was as wild as though I were in a forest. At last my father was the first to notice me. He called me to him and asked me why I stared at him so. I don't remember what answer I made. I remember he seemed to reflect, and said at last that next day he would bring me an alphabet and teach me to read. I looked forward to this alphabet with impatience and dreamed about it all night, with no clear idea what an alphabet was. At last, next day, my father really did begin to teach me. Grasping in a couple of words what was required of me, I learned rapidly, for I knew I should please him by doing so. This was the happiest time of my life then. When he praised me for my quickness, patted me on the head and kissed me, I began crying with delight at once. Little by little, my father began to be fond of me. I grew bold enough to talk to him, and often we talked together for an hour without weariness, though sometimes I did not understand a word of what he said to me. But I was somehow afraid of him, afraid he might think I was dull with him, and so I did my very best to pretend to understand everything. To sit with me in the evenings became at last a habit with him. As soon as it began to get dark and he came home, I went to him at once with my reading book. He would make me sit down on a little stool facing him, and after the lesson he would begin to read me a book. I did not understand a word of it, but I laughed continually, blinking to please him very much by doing so. I certainly did interest him, and it amused him to see my laughter. About this time, he began one evening telling me a story. It was the first story it had been my lot to hear. I sat as though spellbound, and burning with impatience as I followed the story. I was carried away to some other realm as I listened to him, and by the end of the tale I was in a perfect rapture. It was not that the story affected me so greatly, no, but I took it all for truth, at once gave full rein to my fertile fancy, and mixed up reality with fiction. The house with the red curtains, too, at once rose before my imagination. Then, I don't know in what way, my father who told me the story appeared as a character acting in it, as well as my mother who seemed to be preventing us going, I don't know where, and at last, or rather first, I myself, with my marvellous daydreams, with my fantastic brain full of wild, impossible phantoms, took a part in it too. All this was so muddled together in my head that it soon turned into a formless chaos, and for a time I lost all touch, all feeling of the present, of the actual, and lived in an unreal world. At that time I was dying with impatience to speak to my father of what was awaiting us in the future, what he was himself expecting, and where he would take me with him, when at last we should leave our garret. For my part, I was convinced that all this would soon come to pass, but how and in what form all this would be I could not tell, and worried myself racking my brains over it. At times, and it would happen particularly in the evenings, it seemed to me that in another minute my father would beckon me on the sly and call me out into the passage. Unseen by my mother, I would snatch up my reading book as I went, and also our picture, a wretched lithograph which had been hanging unframed on the wall from time immemorial, and which I was quite determined to take with us, and we should run away in secret, and never come back home to mother again. One day, when mother was not at home, I chose a moment when father was in a particularly good humour. That happened to him when he had just drunk wine. Went up to him and began speaking about something with the intention of immediately turning the conversation to my treasured secret. And, hugging him tight with a throbbing heart, frightened as though I were going to speak of something mysterious and terrible, I began, speaking disconnectedly and faltering over every word, to ask him where were we going, whether it would be soon, what we should take with us, how we should live, and finally, whether we were going to live in the house with the red curtains.
House? Red curtains? What do you mean? What nonsense are you talking, silly?
Then, more frightened than ever, I began explaining to him that when mother died, we should not go on living in the garret, that he would take me away somewhere, that we should both be rich and happy, and assured him at last that he had promised me all this. And as I did so, I was fully persuaded that my father really had spoken of it before. Anyway, I fancied it was so.
Your mother? Dead? When your mother is dead?
He repeated, looking at me in amazement, changing his countenance somewhat, and knitting his thick, grizzled eyebrows.
What are you saying, poor foolish child?
Then he began scolding me, and told me over and over again that I was a silly child, that I did not understand anything. And I don't remember what else, but he was very much upset. I did not understand a word of his reproaches. I did not understand how it wounded him that I had listened to what he had said to my mother in anger and intense misery, had remembered his words, and had brooded over them by myself. Whatever he was at that time, however far his own madness had gone, yet all this must naturally have been a shock to him. Yet, though I did not understand why he was angry, it made me horribly sad and miserable. I began to cry. It seemed to me that all that was awaiting us was so important that a silly child like me must not dare to talk of it. Moreover, although I did not understand this at the first word, yet I felt, in an obscure way, that I had wronged my mother. I was overcome by dread and horror, and doubt crept into my heart. Then, seeing that I was crying and miserable, he began comforting me, wiped away my tears with his sleeve, and told me not to cry. We sat for a little time in silence, however. He frowned and seemed to be pondering something, then began speaking to me again. But however much I tried to attend, everything he said seemed to me extremely obscure. From some words of that conversation which I have remembered to this day, I conclude that he explained to me that he was a great artist, that nobody understood him, and that he was a man of great talent. I remember, too, that, asking whether I understood, and receiving, of course, a satisfactory answer, he made me repeat, "of talent," at which he laughed a little, for perhaps in the end it struck him as funny that he should have talked with me of a matter so important to him. Our conversation was interrupted by the arrival of Karl Fyodoritch, and I laughed and grew cheerful again when Father, pointing to him, said to me, "Now, Karl Fyodoritch here hasn't a ha'porth of talent." This Karl Fyodoritch was a very interesting person. I had seen so few people at that period of my life that I could not possibly forget him. I can picture him now. He was a German whose surname was Meyer. He was born in Germany and had come to Russia, set upon getting into a ballet. But he was a very poor dancer, so he could not get taken on for any part in which dancing was necessary, and was only employed as a super in the theatres. He played various dumb parts, such as one of the suite of Fortinbras, or one of those knights of Verona who, to the number of 20, flourish cardboard daggers and shout all at once, "We will die for our king!" But certainly no actor in the world was more passionately devoted to his parts than Karl Fyodoritch. The most dreadful misfortune and sorrow of his life was that he could not get into a ballet. He put the art of the ballet above every other, and was in his way as devoted to it as my father was to the violin. He had made friends with my father when they were both employed at the theatre, and the unsuccessful dancer had never given him up since. They saw each other very often, and together bewailed their hard lot, and that their talents were not recognised. The German was the most sentimental, soft-hearted man in the world, and he cherished for my stepfather the most ardent and disinterested affection. But Father, I fancy, was not particularly attached to him, and only put up with his company for lack of any other. Moreover, Father was so exclusive that he could not see the art of the ballet was an art at all, and this wounded the poor German to tears. Knowing his weak spot, he always touched upon it, and laughed at the luckless Karl Fyodoritch when the latter grew hot and excited, trying to refute him. I heard a great deal about Karl Fyodoritch later on from B., who always called him the Nuremberg Skipjack. B. told me a great deal about this friendship with my father. More than once they met, and after drinking a little, shed tears over their fate, over the fact that they were not recognized. I remember such interviews. I remember also that, looking at the two eccentric creatures, I began whimpering too, though I did not know why. This always happened when my mother was not at home. The German was dreadfully frightened of her, and would always stand outside in the passage waiting till someone went out to him, and if he heard that my mother was at home, he ran downstairs again at once. He always brought some German poetry with him, and became intensely excited reading it aloud to us, and then recited it, translated into broken Russian, for our benefit. This greatly amused Father, and I laughed till I cried. But once they got hold of something in Russian over which they were both very enthusiastic, so that they almost always read it over when they met. I remember that it was a drama in verse by some celebrated Russian writer. I knew the first few lines of this drama so well that when I came across it many years afterwards, I recognized it without difficulty. This drama treated of the troubles of a great artist, Gennaro, or Jacobi, who cried on one page, "I am not recognized," and on another, "I am famous," or "I have no talent," and a few lines farther on, "I have talent." All ended very pathetically. The play was, of course, a very poor one, but, strange to say, it affected in the most naive and tragic way the two readers, who found in the leading character a great resemblance to themselves. I remember that sometimes Karl Fyodorich was so ecstatic that he would leap up from his seat, run into the opposite corner of the room, and urgently, insistently, with tears in his eyes, beg father and me, whom he always called Mademoiselle, at once upon the spot, to judge between him and his fate and the public. Thereupon he would fall to dancing and executing various steps, crying out to us to tell him at once whether he was an artist or not, and whether anything could be said to the contrary, that is, that he had no talent. Father would at once grow merry and wink at me on the sly as though to let me know that he would make fun of the German in a most amusing way. I was immensely diverted, but father would hold up his hand, and I would control myself, choking with laughter. I cannot help laughing even now at the mere memory of it. I can see that poor Karl Fyodorich now. He was a very little, extremely lean, grey-headed man with a red-hooked nose stained with snuff and grotesque bow legs. But in spite of that, he seemed to be proud of their shape and wore tightly-fitting trousers. When he stopped at the last caper in an attitude, holding out his hands to us and smiling as dancers smile on the stage when they have finished their steps, father, for some moments, remained silent, as though he could not make up his mind to pronounce judgment, and purposely left the unrecognized dancer in his attitude, so that the latter began swaying from side to side on one leg, doing his utmost to preserve his balance. At last, father would glance towards me with a very serious face, as though inviting me to be an impartial witness of his judgment. And at the same time the timid, imploring eyes of the dancer were fastened upon me. "No, Karl Fyodorich, you haven't done it," father would say at last, pretending that it grieved him to utter the bitter truth. Then a genuine groan broke from the chest of Karl Fyodorich, but he recovered himself instantly, with still more rapid gesticulations, begged our attention again, declared that he had been dancing on the wrong system, and besought us to criticize him once more. Then he ran off again to the other corner, and sometimes hopped so zealously that he knocked his head against the ceiling and bruised himself badly, but heroically bore the pain like a Spartan, again stopped in an attitude, again with a smile, stretched out trembling hands to us, and again begged us to decide his fate. But father was relentless, and answered gloomily as before, "No, Karl Fyodorich, it seems it's your fate. You've not done it." Then I could restrain myself no longer, and broke into peals of laughter, in which my father joined. Karl Fyodorich noticed at last that we were laughing at him, turned crimson with indignation, and with tears in his eyes, with intense, though comic feeling, which made me feel miserable afterwards on the poor fellow's account, said to father,
"You are a treacherous friend."
Then he would snatch up his hat and run away from us, swearing by everything in the world that he would never come again. But these quarrels did not last long. A few days later he would come to see us again, and the reading of the celebrated drama would begin once more. Once more tears would be shed, and once more the simple-hearted Karl Fyodorich would ask us to judge between him and the public and his fate. Only he would entreat us this time to judge seriously, as true friends should, and not to laugh at him. One day Mother sent me to the shop to make some purchase, and I came back carrying carefully the small silver change I had been given. As I went up the stairs, I met my father, who was coming up from the yard. I laughed to him because I could not restrain my feeling when I saw him, and bending down to kiss me, he noticed the silver money in my hand. I had forgotten to say that I had studied the expression of his face so carefully that I could detect almost all his wishes at the first glance. When he was sad, I was racked with misery. He was most often and most acutely depressed when he had no money, and so could not get a drop of the drink to which he had accustomed himself. But at the moment when I met him on the stairs, it seemed to me that something particular was passing in his mind. His lustreless eyes shifted uneasily. For the first moment he did not notice me. But when he saw the shining coins in my hand, he suddenly flushed, then turned pale, stretched out his hand to take the money from me, then at once drew it back. Evidently there was a struggle going on within him. Then apparently he mastered himself, told me to go upstairs, went down a few steps, but suddenly stopped and hurriedly called me. He was very much confused.
"Listen, Nietochka," he said, "give me that money. I'll give it to you back. You will give it to Daddy, won't you? You are a good little thing, Nietochka."
I felt that I had known this was coming. But for the first instance, the thought of Mother's anger, timidity, and, above all, an instinctive shame on my own account and my father's, restrained me from giving him the money. He saw that in a flash and said hastily,
"Oh, you needn't! You needn't!"
"No, no, Daddy, take it. I will say I lost it, that the children next door took it."
"Oh, very well, very well. I knew you were a clever girl," he said, smiling with quivering lips, no longer concealing his delight when he felt the money in his hands. "You are a kind girl. You are my little angel. There, let me kiss your hand."
Then he seized my hand and would have kissed it, but I quickly pulled it away. I was overcome by a sort of pity and began being more and more agonizingly ashamed. I ran upstairs in a sort of panic, abandoning my father without saying goodbye to him. When I went into the room, my cheeks were burning and my heart was throbbing with an overwhelming sensation I had never known till then. However, I had the boldness to tell my mother that I had dropped the money in the snow and could not find it. I expected a beating at least, but it did not come off. Mother certainly was beside herself with distress at first, for we were dreadfully poor. She began scolding me, but at once seemed to change her mind and left off, only observing that I was a clumsy, careless girl, and that it seemed I did not love her much, since I took so little care of her property. This observation hurt me more than a beating would have done. But Mother knew me. She had noticed my sensibility, which often reached the pitch of morbid irritability, and thought by bitter reproaches for not loving her to impress me more strongly and make me more careful in the future. Towards dusk, when my father was to come home, I waited for him as usual in the passage. This time I was in a terrible state of mind. My feelings were troubled by something which sickeningly tortured my conscience. At last my father came in, and I was greatly relieved at his coming. I seemed to think it would make me feel better. He had already been drinking, but on seeing me at once assumed a mysterious and embarrassed air, and drawing me aside into a corner, looking timidly towards our door, took out of his pocket a cake he had bought, and began in a whisper, bidding me never to take money again and hide it from Mother, that that was bad and shameful and very wrong, that it had been done this time because Daddy needed the money very much, but that he would give it back, that I could say afterwards I had found it again, and to take from Mother was shameful, and that for the future I must not dream of it, and that if I were obedient for the future, he would buy me some cakes again. In the end, he even added that I must feel for Mother, that Mother was so ill and so poor that she worked for us all. I listened in terror, trembling all over, and tears rushed into my eyes. I was so overwhelmed that I could not say a word and could not move from the spot. At last he went into the room, told me not to cry nor say anything about it to Mother. I noticed that he was fearfully upset himself. All the evening I was in a panic and did not dare to look at him or go near him. He too evidently avoided my eyes. Mother was walking up and down the room and was talking to herself as usual, as though she were in a dream. That day she was feeling worse. She had had some sort of attack. At last my mental sufferings began to make me feverish. When night came on, I could not go to sleep. I was tormented by delirious dreams. At last I could not bear it and began crying bitterly. My sobs wakened my mother. She called to me and asked me what was the matter. I did not answer, but wept more bitterly. Then she lighted a candle, came up to me, and began trying to soothe me, thinking I was frightened by something I had dreamed. "Oh, you silly little thing," she said. "You still cry when you have a bad dream. Come, give over." And then she kissed me, saying I should sleep with her. But I would not, and dared not hug her or go to her. My heart was torn in unimaginable tortures. I longed to tell her all about it. I was on the point of doing so, but the thought of Father and his prohibition restrained me. "Oh, you poor little Nyetochka," said my mother, tucking me up in my bed and covering me up with her old jacket as she noticed that I was shivering with feverish chilliness. "I am afraid you will be an invalid like me." Then she looked at me so mournfully that I could not bear her eyes. I frowned and turned away. I don't remember how I fell asleep, but half awake I heard my poor mother trying for a long time to lull me to sleep. I had never suffered such anguish before. My heart ached painfully. Next morning I felt better. I talked to my father without referring to what had happened the day before, for I divined beforehand that this would please him. He immediately became very cheerful, for he had been frowning whenever he looked at me. Now a sort of joy, an almost childish satisfaction, came over him at my light-hearted air. My mother soon went out, and then he could restrain himself no longer. He began kissing me so that I was almost hysterically delighted, and laughed and cried together. At last he said that he wanted to show me something very nice, that I should be very much pleased to see, for my being such a good and clever girl. Then he unbuttoned his waistcoat and took out a key, which he had hanging round his neck on a black cord. Then, looking mysteriously at me, as though he wanted to read in my face all the delight that in his opinion I must be feeling, he opened a chest and carefully took out of it a black box of peculiar shape, which I had never seen before. He took up this box with a sort of timidity, and was completely transformed. The laughter vanished from his face, and was succeeded by a solemn expression. At last he opened the mysterious box with a key, and took out of it a thing which I had never seen before, a thing, at the first glance, of a very queer shape. He took it in his hands carefully, with a look of reverence, and said that this was his violin, his instrument. Then he began saying a great deal to me in a quiet, solemn voice, but I did not understand him, and only retained in my memory the phrases I knew already, that he was an artist, that he was a genius, that he would one day play on the violin, and that at last we should all be rich and should attain some great happiness. Tears came into his eyes and ran down his cheeks. I was very much touched. At last he kissed his violin and gave it to me to kiss. Seeing that I wanted to look at it more closely, he led me to my mother's bed and put the violin in my hand, but I saw that he was trembling with fear that I might break it. I took the violin in my hands and touched the strings, which gave forth a faint sound. "It's music," I said, looking at Father. "Yes, yes, music," he repeated, rubbing his hands joyfully. "You are a clever child, a good child." But in spite of his praise and his delight, I saw that he was uneasy over his violin, and I was frightened, too. I made haste to give it back to him. The violin was put back in the box with the same precaution. The box was locked up and put back in the chest. Father stroked me on the head again and promised to show me the violin every time I was, as now, clever, good, and obedient. So the violin dispelled our common sadness. Only in the evening, as Father was going out, he whispered to me to remember what he had told me yesterday. This was how I grew up in our garret, and little by little my love—no, I should rather say passion, for I do not know a word strong enough to express fully the overwhelming feeling for my father, which was an anguish to myself—grew into something like a morbid obsession. I had only one enjoyment— thinking and dreaming of him, only one desire, to do anything that would give him the slightest satisfaction. How often have I waited on the stairs for him to come in, often shivering and blue with cold, simply to know one instant sooner of his arrival, and to look at him a little sooner. I used to be almost frantic with delight when he bestowed the slightest caress on me. And meanwhile, it often distressed me dreadfully that I was so obstinately cold with my poor mother. There were moments when I was torn by pity and misery as I looked at her. I could not be unmoved by their everlasting hostility, and I had to choose between them. And I had to take the side of one or of the other, and I took the side of this half-crazy man, solely from his being so pitiful, so humiliated in my eyes, and from his having so incomprehensibly impressed my imagination from the beginning. But who can tell? Perhaps I attached myself to him because he was very strange, even to look at, and not so grave and gloomy as my mother. Because he was almost mad, and often there was something of buffoonery, of childish make-believe about him. And lastly, because I was less afraid of him, and indeed had less respect for him than for my mother. He was, as it were, more on my level. Little by little I felt that the ascendancy was even on my side, and that I dominated him a little, that I was necessary to him. I was inwardly proud of this, inwardly triumphant, and realizing that I was necessary to him, even played with him at times. This strange devotion of mine was, indeed, not unlike being in love. But it was not destined to last long. A short time afterwards, I lost my father and mother. Their life ended in a terrible catastrophe, which is deeply and painfully printed upon my memory. This is how it happened.